Well, how are you guys today? Yeah? Okay. Great. I'm glad to see you today. Welcome. If this is your first time, second time, third time, if you're new with us, doesn't matter. I'm glad you're here. Thank you. And if you've been here for a long time, I'm also glad you're here as well. But hey, we're going to be in Esther chapters 1 and 2 today. If you want to turn there or find it on your device, we're starting a new sermon series today called Made for This Moment. It's going to be really fun. We're going to get into it for the next 4 or 5 weeks or so. And so I'm really excited to be there. Man, and before we get started, I do want to highlight two things. The first thing is that just this last week, we had 7 of our leaders go down to a conference in Greensboro from at our sending church, Mercy Hill Church, with the Summit Collaborative. Now, the Summit Collaborative is kind of like one of our other affiliations. I don't know. We're affiliated with a lot of people, I feel like, sometimes. But our two primaries are the Mercy Hill Church Planting Family, which is where we came. We came out of Mercy Hill, and they've planted other churches besides us, and so we're a part of that family of churches. But then over top of them is the Summit Collaborative, and that's kind of like the big umbrella that we're a part of, and we're a part of the Summit Church in Raleigh-Durham. They've planted at least 60 churches domestically in the United States and several hundred churches overseas. So they're on their way to planting 1,000 churches in a generation. We're a part of that vision. And so we always want to be about church planting here. And one of the reasons we took our leaders down to this conference was so that they could get poured into, because we know that when the leaders get better, everybody gets better, right? And so it was really exciting to be around other Summit Collaborative churches. It was really fun for our leaders. They got poured into. We heard J.D. Greer speak, and we heard Brian Laritz speak, and we heard our pastor, Andrew Hopper, speak. I consider him my pastor still at Mercy Hill. And so it was really fun. They got poured into there. And I just wanted to highlight that we pour into our leaders, and we're part of a movement that's just bigger than us, you know. But the second thing is we also had a fun time at the movie night on Friday night. How many of you guys were at the movie night? Yeah, I heard a few. Okay, great. You don't have to raise. I mean, we can clap for that. Yes, thank you. It's fun. It was really fun. We had over 150 people there. We kind of stopped counting then, so there's probably closer to 200 people at it. Just from around the Old Southwest neighborhood, we had an outdoor movie. Encanto was fun. We had bouncy houses and stuff. And just to share one story that came out of that for our family, our kids had a blast. It was our kids' birthday. We have two that share the same birthday on October 7th. And so they had a birthday party that afternoon, and we took them to the outdoor movie night. It was a fun way for them to end their birthday. But they had some friends from school that just happened to be there in the park, at Highland Park. And so those friends just kind of played with them on the bouncy houses and played some games and stuff. They had a good time, and they weren't going to stay for the movie, but they decided to stay. And they ended up sitting with our kids, and the family was close to us and sat with them. But the thing about this family that's friends with my kids is they're Muslims. So they go to the same school, they're Muslims, and they don't know Jesus. And it was really cool for us because we've talked to them before, and they love being in class with their children. Our kids love being in class with them, but they don't know Jesus. And so I've had to sit down and talk to my kids about that before, like, hey, they worship another God that's not our God. And if that's something that you need to talk about, if that's news to you, you know, with Muslims, Islam, then you can come talk to me after the service. I'd love to explain why we believe that. But they don't know Jesus. And so my kids are like, yeah, but they're great people. And I said, I know, they're so sweet. They're so kind. They're so loving. That's why we need to share who Jesus is with them. And so that was one more step for us to just be able to love them and show them that we care about them and that Jesus cares about them. It was really awesome for us. And I know those kinds of stories were happening all over the place that night on Friday. And so I just wanted to share that with you. It was really fun for us. A really good way for us to connect with the culture in a way that shows them hospitality and shows them Jesus's love for them, the love that Jesus wants to show them. So we're going to do those kinds of things periodically as a church just to give you guys the ability to connect with people. Gave us the opportunity, right? Just one more opportunity. It gave us that opportunity to build a relationship with people who need to hear about Jesus's love for them. And in engaging the American culture, it's really difficult sometimes, right? Including here in Roanoke. Especially in this day and age when everything's raging around us. The culture war is raging. The political left and right are always at odds with one another. Oftentimes, as Christians, we get caught up in that fight sometimes, unfortunately, either on one side or the other. Or maybe if you feel like me, you get caught right in the middle of it sometimes. And so it's hard. How do we engage the culture? Well, today, as we start this sermon series in Esther, we're going to see some of these interesting things come up throughout her story. How we should, and maybe more like how we shouldn't engage with our culture, perhaps, especially from today's text in chapters 1 and 2. But Esther has some pretty intriguing things going on here in her story. I don't know if you've ever read through it before or not, but we'll see how, as a religious minority, okay, because we're in the minority, evangelicalism, mainline denominations, all of Christianity is in decline here in Roanoke and in the United States. And so we're in a minority, in a majority culture, different worldview than us. We're going to see how we might relate to this majority culture in a way that furthers God's mission. You know, the Jews were in a dispersion period. It's called the diaspora in Jewish history here. And many of the Jewish people and leaders had been shipped off to Babylon during Israel's 70-year exile. And then it became Persia as the Persian Empire took over the Babylonian Empire. So this is the end of the exile period. And Jewish people left in Susa, so think like modern-day Iran right now, which I looked this up, Susa is not occupied. So that's very interesting if you start to read about some of God's judgment in the Old Testament through some of the other prophets as to the fact that Susa in the Persian Empire doesn't exist anymore, as in there's nobody living there. Okay, it's close to a city that's there, but it's not occupied at all. So think in Iran. And all of these Jewish people left. There's some Jews that have already gone back to Jerusalem. So these guys are a minority of minorities here in this particular context. So they're trying to figure out how to interact with a majority culture. So we're going to see how that looks in Esther, how we should, maybe how we shouldn't. I mean, do you withdraw from the majority culture, which seems totally impossible to do? You can't just completely step out of it and do your own thing. I guess you could try, you know, like The Village, you know, M. Night Shyamalan's movie. Or do you try to fit in and assimilate with a culture where you just make the culture your own, which doesn't seem quite right either, right? We can't just be of the culture. We can be in it, but not of it. Do we try to do something else? Do we protest and rage against the culture, which also doesn't seem super effective or charitable, right? So how do we engage it? Well, Esther's going to explore some of those questions. Maybe it won't give us a specific direction, but it'll at least explore some of those things for us. Very interesting. But then, too, we'll see how a male-dominated society has a woman who's the queen become a major vehicle for social justice here, which is really just kind of interesting on the face of it. It's very countercultural at this time, so that's kind of interesting. Then we can also see how God is exploring some morally ambiguous situations through this book for us. They're really hard to figure out what to do. What's right? What's wrong? Well, I don't know. It's kind of ambiguous for us in Esther. So Esther makes the most of a bad situation in her context. God works through that, despite whether what she does is actually right or wrong, which I'm not saying that our choices don't matter. Of course they do. I've said that all the time. But God is sovereign over it all. And that's kind of helpful and interesting. So it gets at the question of God's will for our lives and how we enter into God's will. So all of these things are going to be explored throughout this series and maybe a little bit more. And Esther's a really interesting book for all of those reasons. But I think maybe the most interesting thing about Esther, and incidentally the most controversial thing about Esther, is that it never mentions God once. Have you guys ever read Esther? There's no mention of God. Not an implication. I mean, there's maybe some undertone implications, but there's never a mention. Not God's name, not God, not like, you know, somebody saying, maybe, perhaps he'll do, no, nothing. There's no mention of God at all. It's very interesting. Go read Esther for this series. It should take you about 30 minutes or less if you sit down and read it all the way through. It's a short story, essentially. And you'll see that God's never mentioned once. Martin Luther, the German reformer back in the late 13th and early 14th centuries, had an opinion of Esther that he liked to share with everybody. Okay, he said he didn't want people to read it. He said he felt like it, of all the Old Testament books, deserved to be excluded the most from the canon of Scripture. He's not even sure how it found its way in there in the Council of Nicaea, because there's no mention of God. There's celebration of paganism and pagan practices. He hated it. But what I want to do is help you see through this series why it's actually awesome that Esther's in the Bible. It's really cool that God leaves it in here for us. It's got some things to teach us if we'll sit under its wisdom and listen to it. And the fact that God is never mentioned is actually intentional. I mean, it's so obvious. It's like, it's not like the author got to the end and was like, whoops, I think I forgot to mention something. You know, I mean, that's not what happened here. He's saying something through the fact that he never mentions God once. And really, I think it's getting at that God works in the world through his people, in and through his people, in a way that's hidden, even when we can't see it. Is it unconventional to exclude any mention of God in the book of the Bible? Sure. It's very unconventional. But it's got a purpose, and we can see what that purpose is as we pay attention to it in this series. So what we're going to see, and you can write this down if you're taking notes, this is our main point for today. God is always working in and through his people. He's always working in and through his people, even when we can't see it, even when it's hidden.
The purpose is unconventional in this book, of course, but it shows us in an ironic and satirical way. So I want you to look for irony as we read through it. I want you to look for satire as we read through it. It's going to show us in those ways that God's always there. You know, it's going to say some things very absurdly on the face of it to show us, of course, God is present here. Of course, all these coincidences can't just line up and just be coincidental. God is moving through it all in a very intentional kind of way, even when we don't see it, making it work together for our good as his people and for his mission and his glory in the world. And in these first two chapters we're studying today, we're going to see a stark contrast between God's king, Jesus, and Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, so the king of Persia, which, you know, it's the same person. A lot of people make a big deal out of this, but really Ahasuerus is just the Hebrew way to say his name, and Xerxes is the Greek alliteration of his name. So that's what we call him, Xerxes, and this is a stark contrast here that we see, this king. And then we see Esther as well. So we're gonna contrast Jesus as king and Xerxes, but then we're going to contrast Esther and Jesus to Jews, right? So there's a contrast that we can see, and I think we can see ourselves in both of these people, Esther and in Xerxes, and we'll see how that works out. And I'm not going to read every word of this, but I'll try to walk through the story as best I can, try to read some key passages and come up for air and talk about it, give some commentary. But make sure you go back and read it yourself, okay? You're going to have to read it. If you want to see what the story is like and go through every word, you're going to have to read it. So let's start at the beginning, chapter 1, verse 1. This is what it says. These events took place during the days of Ahasuerus, who ruled 127 provinces from India to Kush. That's a lot of places. That's the known world at the time. And in those days, King Ahasuerus reigned from his royal throne in the fortress of Susa. And he held a feast in the third year of his reign for all his officials and staff and the army of Persia and Media, the nobles, and the officials from the provinces. He displayed the glorious wealth of his kingdom and the magnificent splendor of his greatness for a total of 180 days. Man, that's a heck of a party. So we're introduced to King of Persia here, Ahasuerus, Xerxes. And this is the Xerxes that we've all heard of from our history class. If you remember your empires class, the Empire of Persia, this is that Xerxes, the famous Xerxes. And of course, most of us know him from the movie 300. Okay, if you're like me and you grew up in the early 2000s and that was your heyday, 300. We all know the King Leonidas and the Spartans at Thermopylae. That's this Xerxes. It's the very same. So he's the one that kills all of the Spartans at Thermopylae. And he's the one whose dad, Darius, let Ezra and the first wave of Jews go back to Jerusalem several years before this to go rebuild the city. So you can see how his story starts to weave in with the Jewish history here. And he reigned for 21 years, only 21 years really, from 486 to 465 BC. So Esther's story is wrapped up in this Persian culture at the height of its power. That's Xerxes is at the very end of the height of the power of the Persian Empire, but you can also see how her story is wrapped up in the broader story that God is returning all of the Jews back to his promised land for them after the. So this is the very end of the Jewish exile. And Xerxes' son, Artaxerxes, would send Nehemiah back to Jerusalem to build the wall up. So you can see how it's kind of sandwiched. Xerxes' reign with Esther is right in the middle of this, between Ezra and Nehemiah. It's very interesting how that all plays together. Maybe even as a result of Esther's being the queen is the reason that, you know, Artaxerxes knew and sent Nehemiah back. We don't know. But Xerxes' rule is characterized here in the Bible and from other sources as opulent and over the top. Just crazy material, hyper materialistic and completely based on vanity and the pop culture idea of beauty at the time. And you can get that sense here from this 180-day party that he threw, right, in the third year of his reign. One commentator I read on this, Karen Jobes, points out that many scholars see this as the beginning of his war council to conquer the Greeks. So he's going to go, you know, it starts with Thermopylae that he wins, and he goes on and it becomes like a four-year war or so against the Greeks. So this is the beginning of that council. He's trying to gather all of the people together that he wants him to go to war with him in this. And he's saying, hey, we're going to throw this party. I want you to see how big and bad we are, how awesome we are. I want you to come in. And we're going to have a party for 6 months, but then ultimately he loses the war against the Greeks 3 years later after this. Very interesting. I mean, he wins at Thermopylae. That's a big deal. The Spartans, the last stand and all of that. And then he loses over the course of the next 3 years. And it's the biggest defeat the Persians will ever suffer. And it begins the decline of their empire. So it's very interesting. The opulence detailed is ironic here then. That's how we need to understand this, because it talks about all these different details. The Jewish audience reading this story, because it was written down after this, multiple years after this, they would have seen the irony here. They're getting the big picture that despite the amount of power and wealth that's being put on display by the author, it's all going to come crashing down in 15 years or so after this. I mean, Xerxes is going to come to ruin and disgrace. They would have known how his life ends. And like many people with wealth and power, it ends very poorly, okay? I mean, he goes and kills his brother several years later and all of his brother's family, because there's a power dynamic there that he wants to make sure he holds on to power. But ironically, he gets killed a few years later by his trusted court members. So he gets murdered. And then his son Artaxerxes is able to hold on to power, keep it within the family. I don't know if Artaxerxes was involved in it. Doesn't say necessarily, or at least I didn't read that in some of the history that I read this week. But man, for all the wealth and power he obtained, it provided no real security in his life. So you can see the irony, right? Like, the irony is that it's detailed out so big, so about 180 days, wealth, power, gathering all of the armies of the earth to go against the Greeks, and then he loses against the Greeks, and then he's ultimately murdered. I mean, it's kind of crazy. So you can write this down. This is the point right here. Worldly wealth and power can never provide real security. They just can't. I mean, and we see this all over history. We see it in our own lives. I mean, the way his wealth and power are described in such detail is just satire. At this point, it's just a farce. You're like, this is ridiculous. We know how the story ends, because it sounds big and impressive, but it's empty and hollow at the end of the story. Right after this, in verses 5 through 9, I mean, it details out in pretty incredible detail. Fine linens, white and purple linens, silver rods, marble columns, gold and silver couches, and fine stone floors. Every cup for every one of the members of this party that's there for 6 months that they drank from was made out of gold, and each cup was individually carved just for that person. I mean, we're talking like the height of wealth and opulence. It reminds me of Jurassic Park. He spared no expense, okay? No expense was spared here. Yet it all goes away in 15 years after this. It ends in disgrace and murder. He put his hope in wealth and power. It's really like a house of cards, right? I mean, if you guys have ever watched, I'm not condoning the show, but it's exactly like the TV show House of Cards, okay? It's always on the edge. It's a razor's edge. You've got to, I mean, one bad decision away from all of it toppling down. One bad economic situation away from it all toppling. One bad enemy who's stronger than you or more cunning than you away from it all toppling down. And that's how it is for us in our lives as well. We think that we can make the best decisions. We think we can save enough. We think we can hold on to enough stuff to make ourselves secure, and we just never can. The wealth and power is fleeting in this life. And in this moment, though, Xerxes don't see that. Okay, he doubles down. So much so that after the six-month party to impress all the leaders in the known world and get them into his campaign in the military, he doubles down for one more week, all right? He gave a royal decree to drink whatever and whenever you want and do whatever you want for one. It's total anarchy, total lawlessness. He decrees this to impress everyone, to win them over. Anything goes. If it wasn't debauched before this during the feast, and now it really gets wild here. And while he did that, his queen Vashti, she throws a party for all the women. So you get a picture here that the men and the women are separated so that they can do whatever they want. There's some real debauchery, promiscuity going on. If there's a woman at the men's party, then you know what she's there for. She's there for one thing only. And it's probably that way for the women in their party with men that are there too. It doesn't say that, but that's the picture that you're getting here. It's a very chauvinistic society of power and wealth, and it's all about the men, and it's all about the sexuality, and it's all about the power. But let's pick up at verse 10. On the seventh day, so at the end of this wild week of partying that he decrees, when the king was feeling good from wine, okay, which is the Bible's way of saying he was drunk. He was plastered, okay? He was feeling good. The end of this week of hedonism, he's drunk, and Ahasuerus commanded all these guys, I'm not even trying to read their names, okay, all these guys, the seven eunuchs who personally served him, to bring Queen Vashti before him with her royal crown. He wanted to show off her beauty to the people and the officials because she was very beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command that it was delivered by his eunuchs, and the king became furious, and his anger burned within him. So the situation gets even more absurd here. I want you to see the absurdity, the irony, the satire in the first part. 6 months of a feast, really? And then 1 week of just total debauchery, whatever you want to do. This is getting crazy. But now he's like, okay, at the end of this, here's my bright idea, right? I want to parade my wife in front of all these guys So they can see her beauty. They can envy me and all that I have. They can see how impressive I am. And I want her to only wear her crown in front of them. That's the implications here, is that she's only wearing her crown. So he wants to parade his wife naked in front of all these perverts here. And of course, she refuses. Now, some scholars think that this was Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. So the Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, right? So it's likely she was forced into this when the Persians overtook the Babylonians. She might have just had enough. There might have been some bitterness there. She didn't want to do it. For whatever reason, she refused. It doesn't say, but you can imagine she doesn't want to be paraded like a piece of meat in front of a bunch of perverts at this party, right? Her husband included. So she says no. And here's a point that's in stark contrast with the culture that I want to make for you guys. You can write it down. People are more than their physical beauty and sexuality. That's the case for the Persian Empire. We need to hear that in our culture today as well, right? I mean, Vashti was really a hero. And that's some of what this story is pointing out here. She refused to be objectified and didn't let even the most powerful man in the known world at the time turn her into just her looks and just her body and just her physical beauty. I mean, the Persians were obsessed with this kind of thing. He wanted to impress everybody. He wanted them to envy him. He wanted to show how beautiful she really was. And of course, we see that in our culture today too, don't we? I mean, we're the epitome of that now, showing off, impressing others. I mean, just think social media. Just think Instagram and TikTok and all these different things, all these filters that people have to put on. And then you see them in real life and you're like, oh my, okay. Didn't realize that that was the case, right? I mean, we see how sexuality is seen and treated in our culture today. Many people derive their identity from their sexuality now. Whoever you have sex with becomes who you are, right? So the question for us now is, how many of us are willing to stand up against that kind of culture in an effective way and say no more? Now, we're not going to do that. That's not how we view people. And I say effective, though, because Vashti got the attention of not only the king, but everybody in the kingdom at the time. Everybody paid attention when she said no. And she was like many of the Jewish heroes. At least that's what the comparison is supposed to be implicit here. We're comparing them to some of the Jewish heroes of the Old Testament, who couldn't listen to the king's command because they had to follow their heavenly king's command, right? So again, the irony is that she's Babylonian here. She's not even Jewish. And she's one of the ones that we're seeing held up as a paragon of virtue in this moment. She's refusing to give in to the culture. She did the right thing and stood up to injustice. We don't really know her motives behind that, but the point is she did what was right. But then we also see that she was punished for it as well, right? She lost her crown. She lost her position of authority. The implication here might even have been that she wasn't just banished, but she might have also been killed for it, which was highly likely. How many of us in this church are willing to stand up to the cultural norms and say, no, you're not going to objectify other people. You're not going to objectify me or my children. No, you're not going to treat people like they're objects. You're not going to devalue people and just make them only their sexuality or only their looks. No. Hey, listen, you're not your sexuality. Listen, you're not how you identify or what gender it is that you want to have. No, that's not what defines you. How many of us are willing to say that in an effective way? And guys, you know me, I keep saying effective because I'm not advocating for us to be ugly at all. We cannot be ugly to people on that. There are people in general chaos right now. There are people who are confused, and that's a reality. We have to be kind and compassionate. But there is an effective way to stand up against these things, because we don't want to go against the gospel. The gospel is grace. The gospel is for everyone, no matter how they identify, right? No matter how confused they might be. I'm confused on some things. I'm not perfect on some things. The gospel is for everyone, but there is a way that we need to stand against this. Jesus did in his day. We see a lot of the biblical characters and the heroes of the faith do this. We have to do the most loving thing sometimes and point out, no, it's not okay to do that. Man, if you're not happy with who God made you to be, let me help you through that, right? Or hey, listen, if you have to identify a certain way in order to be happy, let me help you understand that your identity can be found in something greater, right? We have to do these things. There's no silver bullet answer to do that. So I'm not going to give you any practical things here. Maybe you can go and you can talk about that in your community group this week. But what we can't do is assimilate to the culture. And that's what Esther does. Esther, we'll see as we read on, she assimilates. Now, Vashti doesn't, and we're supposed to contrast the two here. It's in stark contrast to heap burning coals on the head of God's people in this story, I think. And what that means is, if you've never heard that from Proverbs or from even Paul, I think, quotes the Proverbs somewhere in the New Testament. What that means is it brings shame on us, those of us who follow God. Heaping burning coals on somebody means you're heaping shame on them because they say that they do this and they say they follow this and then they don't do it. But Vashti's the one that does it, right? She's not Jewish. She's not God's people. And yet she does the right thing in the story here. And I know that this is a complex issue. So we need to be careful here. Tamara's reading this book, and I'm going to read this after she's done, called Embodied. It's a book by Preston Sprinkle. It's about how to walk through the transgender movement and the transgender concept. And I think it's very helpful. We need to talk about that. We need to learn about those things and try to be compassionate and identify. I think it's worthy for us to do those things, but we can't be led by the culture. That's the point that I'm making here. We can't assimilate into it. We have to lead it to Jesus, right? So let me say it like this: lead the culture, don't be led by it. We're the culture leaders here. That's what God has created us to be. We want to be compassionate. We have to figure out how to do it like Jesus did. But we are the leaders, and we can't let the culture lead us. We're here to lead a restless culture to the redeeming Savior, not to be led into further restlessness by a culture in chaos, right? Esther, again, ironically, doesn't do what Vashti did or what Daniel did. If you remember Daniel's story in Babylon, he refused to let the culture influence how he followed God. But Esther doesn't do that. She doesn't say no like Daniel. She doesn't say no like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. She capitulates to the culture. That's what's so interesting here about this story. She doesn't start off looking much like a hero at all, right? She was compliant with the culture, while Vashti, the non-Jew, is the one who does what's right. And this is where the story's satire, I think, really picks up. Because when Vashti refuses, the picture that's painted is that supposedly this all-powerful king gets together with these, quote, wise counselors. That's, again, I think it's being a little cheeky here, if I can use Bluey's language, all right? Being a little cheeky and saying these wise counselors to figure out what to do about this, because it's a big deal to them. It's absurd. It brings out the absurdity. These group of young men get together, okay, that's question number one, and they're like, hey, you got to do something about this. You can't let this stand. She just talked to you like that. You can't let her do that, because if every woman in the kingdom sees her do this to you, then every woman is going to rebel against her husband. So what you need to do is make a royal decree that says every man is in charge of his own household, right? I mean, it's just like ridiculous stuff. And then, of course, they get the bright idea to say, now you need to banish Vashti and put this into royal law and say that you're going to find another queen that's more compliant than her. That's what you need to do. I mean, you can't hardly make this stuff up. It's so absurd, right? It sounds like an episode of a reality TV show or something like that. And, of course, it sounds like the bright idea of a bunch of, you know, young idiots who are male chauvinists, doesn't it? I mean, of course, young men would come up with this kind of thing. Of course, there's no woman in the room here at all. And Xerxes, who's in his early 30s at this time, he's like, that's a great idea. I'll do exactly what you get. That is why. That's what I want to do, right? I mean, it's ridiculous. So he hosts this, basically a Persian version of The Bachelor. I mean, that's essentially what, I mean, you watch The Bachelor, it looks a lot like that, okay? I mean, that's basically what he does. And all these women come from across the known world at the time to try out to be his queen, and a lot of them are probably forced into it. So on a serious note, there's probably some trafficking going on here. That's what we would call it. People who are chosen, they don't get to choose. That's probably what Esther's situation was. And they're all required to do these beauty treatments and train for a year so that they can be put in front of the king just for one night. They're going to try to win his favor so that they can become the queen. And if they don't become the queen, then they get put in his harem and they don't get to do anything, marry anybody, do anything else in their lives. Of course, they're taken care of, but that's it. Unless they're conquered, unless, you know, somebody comes in and probably kills them all or something. So essentially, they're doomed to widowhood at some level if he's not pleased. So it's really not a good situation here. In chapter 2, verse 5, let's pick it up. It says, in the fortress of Susa, there was a Jewish man named Mordecai. So after all of this stuff, we see Mordecai enter in, son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Okay, so this gives us the place where Mordecai is in the Jewish history. Remember, we've talked about this when we're in Genesis. It's very important to the Jewish people to be able to trace their lineage. And there's reasons for that, because the Messiah is going to come through these lineages. Anyway, let's keep going. Kish had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the other captives when King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon took King Jeconiah of Judah into exile. So we're seeing how Mordecai got here. His dad was brought in, or his grandfather, whatever it is. Mordecai was the legal guardian of his cousin Hadassah, that is Esther. Okay, Hadassah is her Jewish name. Esther is her Persian name, because she had no father or mother. And the young woman had a beautiful figure and was extremely good looking. She was drop-dead gorgeous, is basically the Bible's way of saying that, all right? And when her father and mother died, Mordecai had adopted her as his own daughter. And when the king's command and edict became public knowledge, and when many young women were gathered at the fortress of Susa under Haggai's supervision, Esther was taken to the palace, into the supervision of Haggai, keeper of the women. So Mordecai is introduced. We'll talk more about him in a couple of weeks when we get back into this. But along with Esther here, she's the protagonist of the story, right? Who's chosen to be in the Persian bachelor or whatever it is. She's really attractive. That's what's pointed out. That's probably why. I'm sure there was probably guys just going around saying, hey, you, right? I mean, that's basically what this boils down to. But notice that whether or not she had a choice in the matter, she does go along with it without a fight. And you're like, well, what is she supposed to do? Is she going to get killed in the street? I don't know. I mean, maybe. There's certainly stories of Christians and Old Testament prophets doing that, right? But she doesn't do that. Whether she had a choice or not, she goes along with it without a fight. I mean, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refused to capitulate, and God delivered them miraculously, but she doesn't do that. She does the opposite. She goes into the contest. We see her eat the Persian diet. I mean, that's very specifically pointed out in the language if you go back and read it here, which is what Daniel and the youths refused to do. They're like, hey, let us eat differently. We're different. Let us eat the way that we're Jewish people should eat. She doesn't do that. She even hides her ethnicity so that nobody knows she's Jewish, which means she's certainly not doing any of the ritualistic prayers, right? She's not publicly or probably privately practicing her religion and her belief in God. So she hides all of that. And then she goes through this year-long training. It's a beauty regimen to enhance her physical beauty further than it probably already is. But there's also heavy implications here that this is a training period, that she's getting trained to please the king, if you know what I mean. If I can, you know, give you the nudge and say, like, this is probably a sexual thing here too. It's probably the heavy implications of this. And she plays the game. That's the interesting thing. She plays it so well that she gains favor with Haggai, her supervisor, with all the people who see her, with the king himself, obviously, as we see in the story here in a minute. I mean, she plays the game to win the game. She gains the favor. That means she works for it. Whether God provides it, obviously he's sovereign. He's providing that. But she works for it to gain the favor. So she's in it, man. She's assimilated. She's capitulated. She's fully in this Persian game, and she wins the favor of the king. If you've ever seen the 2006 movie, One Night with the King, I don't want to say anything bad about it. I thought it was a great movie. Well done, well acted, well written even, perhaps. But you see in that movie the story of Esther, where she wins the king over with not just her beauty and not her physical prowess, but with her heart, by connecting with him on a deeper level. And she goes in with a book, you know, maybe even some of the Bible. I don't know, but she wins the king over with her intellect in the movie. And I think that's a really nice sentiment, right? I mean, it is. It's like this. Maybe this was the moment that Esther influence the king in a way that would please God. Maybe this is the moment where she wins him over. Not the one in chapter 4, although that's how the story builds it. So I know there's some artistic license here, and the movie is making a point about Esther, but man, I just don't think she's that kind of hero. I don't think she won over the king with her intellect. It says she's physically beautiful. It says she gains the favor. She plays the game. She goes into the king and gives him the best night of his life, is essentially what it's saying here. And then God brings the favor about in chapter 4, as we'll read about in a few weeks. Honestly, I think everything in this story would lead us to believe that, man, she's probably like an anti-hero here a little bit. I mean, she didn't pray like God commanded her. She didn't worship God like he commanded. She didn't eat what God commanded. She didn't, you know, practice her faith publicly, probably, or privately, we see here maybe. Instead, she changed her name to reflect the Babylonian goddess of love and beauty and fertility and sex. Okay, her name literally is that goddess. Esther is after Ishtar, the goddess of sex and fertility. She entered this contest because of her natural beauty, and she pleases the king the most, which is at least somehow sexual in some way. And she accepts the moniker of queen. She takes the crown of queen of this pagan empire that has enslaved her own people. Now they've started to give the Jews some freedom there, but she wins it, man. Why am I making such a big deal out of this? Because I think the point that the author is making for us here in this book is to see, what are we supposed to do with Esther? We're supposed to ask the question, what do we do with her? She doesn't fit our preferred categories here, right? She's not like other biblical heroes that we see. Honestly, she would be a terrible one if that were the case. She's kind of like the anti-hero, where conservatives will tend to dislike her because she's assimilated into the pagan culture wholeheartedly. She's in it to win it, man. That's extreme liberalism. She's just completely capitulated. But then liberals will tend to dislike her story as well because she was completely subservient to the male chauvinist of the day. She did not use her physical beauty and prowess to manipulate and to gain power. What she did was she used that all to serve the king. She laid down for him, basically. Anyway, we'll keep moving. I mean, she was subservient to the chauvinism of the day. She didn't stand up against it like Vashti did. So feminists aren't going to be thrilled with this story when they read it. And the point that I think that the chapters are making to us and that I want to make to you today is that God works in and through his people despite their sin. Man, that's the absurdity of the story here. I think that's what the author is doing for us in Esther. God works in and through his people despite their sin. You can write that down. That's a note. God is always working in and through his people, even as in Esther's case, when she's so far from what God calls his people to look like. He's still working. Because we're going to see how he orchestrates all of this together to deliver his people. But man, she's not perfect. And don't take this the wrong way. You got to have a little maturity about it, but this is no excuse for us to sin. That's not what this means, right? It's not to say that we shouldn't strive to do what's right in our lives. Of course we should. Paul talks about all of that. Run the race well, all of that. But isn't this reassuring to us? That God is working behind the scenes for our good through us, despite us. Isn't that beautiful? Man, that's the God that we serve. It's a little like the concept of the anti-hero. I've already said that a couple times, but you know, Venom in Marvel universe or Black Adam in DC's universe, these are anti-heroes. They're characters who are, you know, the hero of the story. They're the protagonist, the one that you follow, but it's unconventional because they're not heroic in a lot of ways. I mean, they're really bad guys who end up being good guys. It's not like Walter White in Breaking Bad, the TV show, who was a good guy but ends up being the bad guy, and he realizes that at the end, you know? These guys are different. These are guys that are usually bad guys, or they're either very flawed guys or something like that, but they become the good guy over time, usually after some kind of hard journey, usually after something that shapes them and changes them in a redemptive kind of way. And Esther is going to be that here in this book. It should give us hope that God can work in and through us too, right? He isn't a God who's just waiting for us to slip up just so he can punish us and make us, you know, subservient to these cultural people that are in power or something like that. He might discipline us. He might guide us in certain ways and a direction over time, but he works in and through us knowing that we're not perfect. Maybe we could even say, because we're not perfect, maybe he works in and through us, so that he can change us from the inside out over time. And he gets the glory for that. Maybe there's something much better about having somebody go from imperfect to more like Jesus every single day, over and over and over again, over a long period of time, than there is from saying, do the right thing, and then commanding obedience immediately. That's not the God that we serve, right? I mean, we're all like this, though, at some level. God uses us despite our sin, but we're imperfect. I mean, Esther was imperfect. She hadn't made great choices up to this point. Yet God was preparing the way for her to be used to deliver his people. And we can also compare ourselves, though, not only to Esther, but I think Xerxes here as well. He was all about his own glory, wasn't he? I mean, he threw his own party, you could say. His life was full of himself. That's what he wanted. Have you ever wanted to throw your own party? Make life about yourself? I mean, we all think life is our own party. You could write that down as a note just to remember that. We all think life is our party. Doesn't sound too different in Susa in 483 BC than it does in America today in 2022 AD, does it? Right? We might not all have the wealth and power that he had to do whatever we wanted in those ways, although some names come to mind, like Jeffrey Epstein. I thought about that. It sounds exactly like what he did. Yeah. But we'll do similar things. That's the problem. We'll make life all about how it pleases us. We're constantly chasing after that next material thing that will make us happy, we think. We got to get the better house. We want the newer model of that gadget. We got to have the better car. We think we have to get in the better job. Whatever we think will make us happier, that's what we got to go after, right? We'll do that. And we'll do that because we've let the culture lead us. We're not leading the culture. The culture's that's American culture influencing us. That's not God's culture for us. We're constantly trying to gain the admiration of others. You know, we want to be perceived a certain way or for others to look up to us and to affirm that sense of self-importance that we either already have because we're super prideful or we're desperately craving because we devalue ourselves in an ungodly way, right? We're all about beauty and appearances. I mean, again, think Instagram, TikTok, and all these other things that are out there with the filters and all that. Or think about Hollywood's obsession with plastic surgery. Nobody talks about that. That's a multi-million dollar industry in Hollywood today. They got to look younger, man. And we see it every time we watch a TV show or we watch a movie, and we're being inundated with that without us even realizing the culture is leading us. We're not leading the culture in those times. I mean, think about the way that people look for a spouse today in our culture. What's the number one thing you got to look for in a spouse before anything else? Be honest now. I know, I looked in my own heart, okay? And you know my wife, she's very beautiful. That was the first thing that struck me. Why? Because I've been led by the culture. That's why. And I'm not saying I'm glad she's very beautiful, okay? I'm glad that, but man, there's a lot of you missing out on good spouses probably because that's what you make as your number one priority. I don't know. I mean, we're being led by the culture. That's all. That's a Tim Keller right there. So you can thank Tim Keller for that one. We're all about sexuality or sensuality in our culture too, right? I mean, when you watch pornography or when you watch movies that are explicit and have explicit scenes or TV shows that have explicit scenes and we just make excuses for those things, we're just like, yeah, we're being led by the culture. I mean, there's a new movie out on Netflix called Blonde. I read an article about it because it's supposed to be groundbreaking. It's the first NC-17 movie that Netflix has made. And it's about the life of Marilyn Monroe, which I'm sure is extremely fascinating. She had a very hard life, and it shows some very difficult moments in her life, including an abortion that she doesn't want to be a part of. Now, I haven't watched it. I just read the article about it because I wanted to understand. But it's being hailed as groundbreaking because they're pushing the boundaries of what's appropriate in entertainment and art. And you can say it's art all you want, but it shows explicit moments of abuse. That's either going to trigger somebody who's an abuser or it's going to trigger somebody who's been abused. That's not appropriate. You can do those things in an artistic way, in a way that shows the depth of depravity without showing the depravity. And I think that can even bother the actors and actresses that are involved in that. It's just not good all the way around. But the culture's leading us in those moments when we give into it. We're not leading the culture. What do you think you're asking people to do when you watch those scenes? It's exactly what Xerxes did with Vashti. Stand in front of me naked, right? That's what we're doing when we give in to the sex and sensuality of our culture. All these things and more are the same heart of rebellion that both Esther and Xerxes have. Whose glory were they really living for? That's the question that we're meant to ask here in these chapters. Yet there's a greater Jewish hero that comes into picture. There's a greater king that comes into play who stepped in to bless us despite our sin, right? He wasn't about his own glory. He was about his Father's glory. And of course, that's Jesus. He's the true Jew who, instead of rejecting God and assimilating to the culture, perfectly pictured the true Jewish life that God, the creator king, wanted for him, for his people. Jesus is the true hero of our story. You can write it down that way. He's the true hero. And he's the king who stepped down off of his throne as well into this world of a life of complete compliance. He lived that perfect life, not to the world, not a compliance to the culture, but to his Father in heaven, right? He was the perfect life. His was the perfect life that God says we should all live, but we don't. He did that for us. But then he died the death that we deserve, so he took it one step further. That's what happens when you go against the king. You know that? Like we see that maybe Vashti had happened to her. She was at least banished, probably killed, because she said no to the king of the age. That's what happens when you reject the king's command. You know, it's no different with us and God, though. When we say no to God, when we reject his command, that same thing happens to us. We're either banished, we're killed, we're destroyed, whatever you want to call it. We can go through the Bible and look at that. When we say no to him as our king, we rejected compliance with God for compliance with the culture. We've said yes to another king, right? You and I deserve banishment and death for that. See, Jesus, even though he deserved honor for total compliance with God and his king, he took our punishment on himself. He died for our non-compliance with God. We deserve banishment, but Jesus was separated. He was banished from his Father for us. We deserve death, but he took that death onto himself. So you can write this down. Jesus is the true king we need on the throne of our heart. He's the hero. He's the king. Not Esther, not Xerxes, right? Have you complied with Jesus today? Have you let him rescue you? Man, we can't be like Xerxes here and be our own authority. We just can't. It never works out this way. And just like his reign in 465 BC, it will come to an end one day. If we try to live that way, it'll all come crashing down on us. We make terrible gods for ourselves. We make terrible kings. And if you're honest, you can see that in your life, right? You make bad choices every day. You take advantage of other people every day. You can't even live up to the own standards you set for yourself, much less live up to God's perfect standards for your life. But then we also can't be like Esther in this story either, who is completely compliant to the world. She let Xerxes be the hero of her story. She wanted him to save her. She wanted to become the queen for Xerxes, bring all that wealth and power to bear. She wanted that. She assimilated to the Persian Empire so that they became her people. And we can't do that here in this life. Yeah, we're in this culture, but we can't be of the culture, right? They're not our people in that way. We're God's people. And those who follow God as their king will be saved and delivered. We have to bow our knee to King Jesus, who deserves to sit on the throne of our heart. What other king gave up his eternal wealth and power to step down into this life and make us beautiful? I mean, look at the story here, right? All these thousands of women had to come to Xerxes and be made beautiful for a year before they could even stand in front of him. But Jesus didn't do that with us. He didn't say, you got to come to me and be beautiful. He said, I'm going to come to you and make you beautiful. That's what our king does for us. Our king makes us beautiful. He doesn't expect us to come to him in a perfect way. The command isn't do these things so that you can come to me. We talked about that in our last sermon series, right? Last week. It's the command isn't, hey, you got to follow the Ten Commandments so that you can come to me. Hey, you've got to change your sexual identity so that you can come to me. Hey, you've got to believe the right things so that you can come to me. No, no, no. What's the command? Come to me. The command is come to me. Come because you're weary and you're burdened. Come because you're restless. Come because you can't save yourself. Come because you are not beautiful. Come to me. I will give you rest. Come to me. I will take your burden. Come to me. I will make you beautiful. That's the king that we serve. This culture doesn't want that for you. This culture wants you to make yourself beautiful. This culture will destroy you if you're not what they want you to be. The kings of this age do not care about you the way that the God of this age cares about you. He's the God of the universe, and he wants you so bad, he's willing to come in and die for you. If you go to Jesus, he'll start to bring the oils and the spices and the beauty regimen of the Holy Spirit into your life. And it'll begin to change you, not from the outside in, but from the inside out. That's the power of the God that we serve. It's hidden. We can't see it working, just like we can't see him in the story, but he's there. He's doing it for you and through you, if you'll let him. That's what's going to make you beautiful in this life. Here's how I'll end. It's not our party. We're here where we are in this place and time in history for this moment. I know I haven't said that the whole time. We're going to get into that when we get into chapter 4, right? You were made for this moment. God has saved you for this moment. He's making you beautiful for this time, for his glory, not your own. Whose glory is it that you're living for? Is it yours or is it his? Live for his glory. And like Esther and Xerxes, we're not perfect, but God will use us anyway if we're willing to bow to him. We have an opportunity to impact our culture if we'll start to lean into that mission with him and lean into the gospel that can change you from the inside out. We'll see over the course of the rest of this series in Esther's story that she matures in that. That's the hope, man. We can see her finally in chapter 4, she gets it. She finally gets it. But it takes her a while to get there, doesn't it? Maybe that's your story right now. She goes from being a cultural sellout to being God's primary instrument of deliverance for his people. It's a beautiful story of redemption. Wherever you find yourself today, whether it's trying to clean yourself up to win the approval of people in our culture, or clean yourself up to win the approval of our God, you need to know that that's not what he asks of you. That's not where true beauty comes from. Man, if you're not a Christian here today, you wouldn't say you follow Jesus. I would implore you, let him make you beautiful. He died for you to do that. He's the true hero. He's the true king. Bow yourself to him, maybe for the first time today. And if you're a Christian here today, man, let's worship this God. We've said that he's our hero. We've said that he's our king. Are you living that way today? Are you still letting the culture kind of influence you, letting the culture lead you a little bit? Again, I haven't maybe applied that in every single way possible. You're going to have to do that this week. Go talk to your community group. But man, let's worship this God today because of what he's done for us. Let me pray. God, I'm so thankful that Jesus is the true hero. He's the true king. He died for us. He's the king that doesn't call us to come to him with a beauty regimen and make ourselves cleaned up, all of these different things. No, no, no. He makes us beautiful from the inside out. Praise you, God. Praise you that that's the story of the gospel. Praise you that that's what gives us true rest in a restless culture. God, I pray for our people that we will lead this culture to you, that we won't let the culture influence us. God, thank you, though, that in our imperfections, in those moments where we do let the culture lead us, you're still working. You're still working. You're still using us. We can rely on your sovereignty. What joy, what assurance we have knowing that we serve a God who's greater than all of our sin in every way possible, in every way that that looks. God, thank you that you want to use us. Thank you so much that we get to participate in the mission with you. God, you are good, and we worship you today. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.